Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 171, The Gathering Storm. Oh my goodness, the History of Rome tour is so much fun. We don't have firm dates for the next round, but historyofrometour.com. Check it out. It is so much fun. Also, as you may have noticed, a combination of jet lag and conflicting responsibilities have conspired to leave this episode a bit shorter than usual, but we will be back in full effect next week, I promise. Okay, where were we? Ah, yes. It's 447 AD, and Attila the Hun is loose in the Central Empire. The Theodosian walls have managed to hold him off, but unfortunately, almost nothing else was able to say the same thing. Forts, garrisons, cities, armies, all overrun, ransacked, and left dazed and traumatized. But consistent with the standard Hun policy of the last 15 years, Attila was not actually interested in annexing Roman territory, or in trying to conquer the empire per se. As you'll recall, the whole trigger for this lightning campaign had been Constantinople's experiment with not paying the indemnity that they had agreed to, an experiment Attila hoped Constantinople now recognized to be a complete failure. Also consistent with standard Hun policy, Attila took the opportunity to jack up the going rate for keeping the Huns out of the field from 1,400 to 2,100 pounds of gold per year. And, oh yeah, we're going to need that 6,000 pounds of gold you already owe us up front. Left with no other choice, and probably just happy that there was a choice, besides the Huns kick the crap out of us indefinitely, Theodosius II agreed to the terms. Now, I haven't really talked about this yet, but the Huns' indemnity policy goes a long way towards establishing them as something more advanced than your average snatch-and-grab barbarians. They were not at all interested in killing the goose that laid their golden egg. Sure, sometimes you had to go down and kick the goose around a bit if it tries to stop laying golden eggs, but you don't kill it. You let it live. The Huns were far-sighted enough to recognize that just blasting the Romans out of the water wouldn't be any good for anyone. They had this nice advanced economy that had long established trade networks crisscrossing the Mediterranean and that reached as far afield as India and China. Why mess that up? So as much as they could afford to, they didn't mess it up. They pushed it around some, sure, but it was imperative to leave the Roman economic structure intact, so that every year it could deposit 2,100 pounds of gold on their doorstep. So as much as the Huns have been portrayed as mindless barbarian demons rampaging mindlessly across late antiquity, they strike me as pretty savvy operators. Meanwhile, off in the west, just as Theodosius and the Eastern Empire were agreeing to pay whatever the Huns wanted, Flavius Aetius was in the process of imposing his own terms on another branch of wayward Franks. Though the peripheral provinces of the West were slipping away, the central imperial authority was determined to hold on to the core provinces in Italy, Gaul, and Spain. So in 448, Aetius was in northwest Gaul once again, this time battling and defeating an independent-minded Frankish king named Clodio. This battle with the Franks is, in and of itself, not particularly important. But for those of you interested in long-discredited conspiracy theories that get plagiarized by hack writers and turned into inexplicable bestsellers, you'll be happy to know that Clodio is on the short list of candidates for the title Founder of the Merovingian Dynasty. According to official legend, it was Clodio's successor and possible son, Merovech, who founded the dynasty and gave it its name. But since Merovech is a semi-mythical figure whose actual existence is disputed, some scholars point to Clodio as the real founder of the dynasty, which means that he, like, married the descendants of Jesus and Mary Magdalene or something. I don't really know. It's been a long time since I read Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Anyway, Aetius defeated Clodio and dragged one of the Frankish king's sons down to Milan to act as a hostage and keep the nascent Merovingians in check. Or maybe to keep the power of Jesus' bloodline for himself. Or something. The other reason the battle against Clodio is important is that it marks the first appearance of two men who will shortly move to the forefront of our story, both of whom likely fought under Aetius in the battle. Julius Valerius Majorianus, who would, through a series of twists and turns, become emperor of the Western Empire in late 457, and Flavius Ricimer, the German general who would follow in the footsteps of Stilicho and Aetius, place his old friend Majorian on the throne at the beginning of a 16-year run as de facto ruler of the Western Empire. Majorian, born in the 420s, was the grandson of one of Theodosius I's top generals, and was just at the point of his career where people were beginning to take notice. At the battle against Clodio, he rode at the head of a cavalry detachment that seized control of a critical bridge, helping to secure victory early in the fight. He was young enough, capable enough, and prominent enough that Valentinian III seriously considered marrying his youngest daughter Placidia to Majorian in the early 450s. But Aetius, determined that his own son should marry Placidia, undermined his subordinate at court, and then expelled Majorian from the army. Majorian would remain in exile until Aetius' death in 454, whereupon he and Ricimer would come crashing back into the picture in the chaotic aftermath of Aetius' assassination. Ricimer, on the other hand, was much older, probably born around 405. He was a noble Goth related to the royal family by way of his mother, who was either the late King Wallia's daughter or sister, depending on which source you read. His date of birth means that he was likely born in Illyria during the period of tension, then partnership, and then tension again between Alaric and Stilicho. It also means that as he grew up, he was present for every step of the great and terrible Goth migration. Into Italy, out of Italy, down to sack Rome, up to Gaul to defeat Jovinus, trapped in Spain, allowed to settle in Aquitaine, the works. Though he was just a boy, Ricimer witnessed firsthand what it meant to be a major player in the cunning and dangerous world of war and politics, and he appears to have learned his lessons well. When it came time for him to make his own bid for power in the mid-450s, he neither flinched nor slipped. We will have much, much more to say about Ricimer as we move forward. The man legendary Cambridge historian J.B. Barrie called the first German king of Italy, the link between Stilicho and Odoacer. 449 AD, the year after Theodosius' settlement with Attila and Aetius' victory over Clodio, was the calm before the storm. However, the storm that would break in 450-451 was not the one that an objective observer likely would have predicted. Thus far, Attila's attention had been focused entirely on the Eastern Empire. Neither he nor his predecessors had shown much interest in moving west, and you would think that any temptation Attila might have had to go poke that golden goose would have been tempered by two facts. First, that at this point the Western Empire was neither as rich nor as stable as the Eastern Empire. It was clearly the inferior imperial twin. And second, he was on excellent terms with Aetius, the ruler of that inferior twin. Far from viewing the Western Empire as a potential adversary, Attila almost certainly considered the Western Empire to be a stable ally. And absolutely nothing about Aetius's conduct indicated that the Hun king should think any different. So you take those two basic points, and you add them to the fact that in mid-449, the imperial chamberlain of the Eastern Empire made a ham-fisted attempt to assassinate Attila with, like, exploding cigars or something, you would think that the crisis that began in 450 would have been a second invasion of the East by Attila. But it wasn't, was it? Attila's decision to invade the West, rather than put another boot to the throat of the East, is quadruply hard to wrap your head around because of a massively destabilizing horseback ride that took place in July of 450. While out on a ride, Theodosius II fell from his horse, broke his neck, and died. He was 49 years old and had ruled the East for a kind of astounding 42 years. Just as suddenly as you please, the Eastern Empire had no emperor, which is exactly the sort of thing you'd think a ticked-off and opportunistic-minded Attila might want to take advantage of. But he never did. Theodosius II had just one living daughter, Licinia Eudoxia, and she had gone west to Milan after marrying Valentinian III. Thus far, Valentinian and Eudoxia had two children of their own, both girls, 11-year-old Eudoxia and 7-to-9-year-old Placidia. This meant that the next ruler of the Eastern Empire was going to have to be chosen, a moment always fraught with extreme danger, and a moment the East had not dealt with in almost 60 years. This particular moment was even more dangerous, because while neither of Theodosius's granddaughters were married, Eudoxia had been betrothed in the mid-440s to, wait for it, Hunneric, the son of the Vandal king Genseric. This engagement had been a political arrangement to help ease tensions between the Vandals and Romans, but right now, it suddenly meant that Hunneric might be in line for the throne of Constantinople. Luckily, the wedding had not taken place yet. Eudoxia's younger sister, Placidia, was too young for anyone to have settled on a future husband for her yet, although, as I just mentioned, Aetius was likely angling from the start for his own son to get the nod. So where did that leave the Eastern Empire? Who was going to step up, and how were they going to be legitimized? The answer finally came from the late Theodosius's powerful sister, Aelia Pulcheria. Though she was no longer the all-powerful figure she had been early in her brother's reign, Pulcheria had lost none of her brains or backbone, and she had remained an influential force in Eastern politics. When Theodosius died, Pulcheria immediately stepped into the power vacuum and began issuing orders as the official sovereign of the empire, sort of the same way she had stepped in as a 15-year-old girl back in 412 and declared herself regent over her younger brother Theodosius. For about a month, the single and loving it Pulcheria acted as ruler of the East, until the Senate in Constantinople finally broke under the weight of their own incredulity. Things cannot go on like this. The Augusta has to find a husband. We'll ratify whoever you choose and make him emperor, but seriously, please, we cannot handle the embarrassment of being ruled by a woman. I'm sorry, we wish it didn't have to be like this, but we're a patriarchal society full of unrepentant misogynists, so please, please, find a husband. So Pulcheria plucked someone close at hand who wouldn't cause her too much trouble. Captain of the household guard, Flavius Marcianus. Marcian had been born in Illyria around 392 and had risen up the ranks through the bureaucratic wing of the imperial governing apparatus rather than the military wing. But that did not mean he was completely inexperienced with the art of war or disdained by the Eastern generals. Indeed, his main sponsor for Pulcheria's hand in marriage was the general Aspar, who had led the campaign in North Africa that had led to the first settlement between the Vandals and Rome back in 435. According to legend, Marcian had been on that campaign and had actually been captured by the Vandals. Brought before Genseric, the Vandal king had a premonition that Marcian would one day rule the Eastern Empire, and so the king released the young officer on the promise that he would never again make war on the Vandals. A story that I'm sure is 100% accurate and not at all contrived after-the-fact propaganda. Another story that I'm sure is 100% accurate and not at all contrived after-the-fact propaganda is the one about a dying Theodosius with his last breath naming Marcian to be his heir. Uh-huh. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. Marcian was crowned in August 450, and making sure that no one missed the point, Aelia Pulcheria was the one who placed the diadem on Marcian's head. Point taken, Your Highness. So we're going to leave it there for this week. But next week, another arranged imperial marriage, this one between Valentinian III's sister Honoria and a bland and upstanding Roman senator named Bassus Herculanus, would suddenly lead to one of the greatest crises in the history of the Roman Empire, the Hun invasion of the West. How are these two events linked? Well, if an imperial princess who doesn't want to marry a bland and upstanding Roman senator sends you a plea for help and includes in the package a ring, aren't you going to take that as a marriage proposal? And welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 172, Showdown. So last week, we left off in 450 AD with two imperial marriages. The first, in the east, between Flavius Marcianus and Aelia Pulcheria, that saw the man we call Marcian elevated to the rank of Augustus. The second, in the west, was between Honoria and the senator Bassus Herculanus, which saw the Western Empire brought to the brink of ruin. But just to the brink of ruin. As we will see today, whatever criticisms and judgments you want to lob at Aetius for being a conniving backstabber or for letting North Africa slip away and hardly lifting a finger, they must be offset at a minimum by his handling of the invasion of Attila the Hun. Aetius, of course, had many positive qualities that already offset those negatives, but even if he didn't, I think the way he managed to hold the line against Attila is enough to balance any scale. Aetius was at his best when the chips were down, and he would be at his absolute best in 451 when it came time to face Attila in battle. The Western Empire was falling, but not yet. Aetius is a big reason why. So as I alluded at the end of the last episode, in 450 AD, the court of Valentinian III had a problem, namely the emperor's older sister, Honoria. Unlike the imperial ladies of the court in Constantinople, who had all taken vows of chastity, a vow, by the way, that Marcian had been forced to respect when he married Aelia Pulcheria, Honoria wanted a bit more out of life. She thus gained a reputation for herself not unlike the reputation gained once upon a time by the Julias, elder and younger. Honoria managed to remain unmarried for quite a while, but finally her scandals mounted up, and her mother, Galla Placidia, prepared to marry her off to the aforementioned Herculanus, whose sole redeeming quality was an utter lack of ambition. After all, whoever married the sister of the emperor stood a fairly decent chance of becoming emperor himself one day. Just look at Marcian. But Herculanus was dull and predictable, qualities prized by Galla Placidia and despised by Honoria. So, the story goes, in a dramatic fit, she sent a messenger to find the great Attila the Hun and ask him for help, and closed with her note begging to be rescued from the prospect of a boring life with a boring man was one of Honoria's rings, which she perhaps meant to be no more than proof that the note was indeed from the emperor's sister, but which Attila took to be a wedding proposal. At least, that's the way the story goes. Now, Whether Attila genuinely misunderstood the message or intentionally misunderstood the message is open for debate. Whichever it was, Attila responded by declaring himself ready to marry Honoria and demanding, oh, let's say, half the Western Empire as a dowry, which was, of course, completely insane. When the imperial court scoffed at this demand, Attila began to prepare an invasion, which was, of course, also completely insane. Why would he mobilize his entire army just to come to the aid of some spoiled princess he had never met? And that's when we start to notice that the farther along we get, the less plausible the I am coming to rescue the princess story gets. Especially since, as those of you who are reading ahead know, Attila doesn't invade Italy after receiving the note from Honoria. No, he skirts the Alps and invades Gaul. Honoria's plea may have made for a convenient pretext, but clearly it wasn't anything more than a pretext. His demand for half the empire as a dowry was only serious in that the inevitable Roman rejection of the offer gave him a further pretext. I mean, hey, I've just been insulted. I have to go teach these swine a lesson. You know, that sort of thing. So what gives? Why was Attila suddenly of the mind to invade the West? As we discussed last week, the West was both poorer in wealth and friendlier to the Huns in disposition. The answer likely lies, first of all, in that general drive to expand that seems to grip any great power. Once you think you're invincible, it follows that the world should be yours. Rich, poor, friend, foe, all should bow before you. So it was expansion, for expansion's sake, the manifest destiny of irresistible power. Second was a political hole that had just opened up in Gaul at that moment. The Frankish king Clodio, the one who had been beaten by Aetius a couple years before, keeled over dead in 450, and the question of succession to the Frankish throne was suddenly opened up. Aetius and the Romans backed Clodio's younger son, the one Aetius had taken hostage, and the one Aetius had then subsequently adopted as his own son, following Clodio's death. Attila, on the other hand, backed Clodio's elder son to fill the vacancy, obviously hoping to peel the Franks away from the Romans and draw them into the Hun hegemony. For the first time, ever really, Aetius and Attila were on opposing sides of an issue. Aetius wanted his new adopted son in power to ensure that the Franks remained staunch Roman allies, and Attila was prepared to back with arms the claim of the elder son, who was promising to look east to the Huns rather than south to the Romans. Neither Aetius nor Attila would back down. But the question of Frankish succession was not the only political front Attila was working in the West. He was apparently running some kind of multi-pronged offensive to split everyone from everyone else, probably hoping to create enough chaos that he could just waltz into Gaul unopposed. He sent envoys to Aetius asking for an alliance because, he announced, he was planning to attack the Goths in Aquitaine, who, after all, have been nothing but a thorn in your side for years. Who would you rather team up with, some untrustworthy Goths squatting on your land, or the mighty Huns, who have always been there when you needed us? But at the same time, Attila was sending envoys to the Goths, essentially making the same argument in reverse. Hey, let's team up and drive the Romans out of Gaul once and for all. You don't like them any more than we do, and together we can be rid of them. Meanwhile, he was sending a mix of threats and overtures to the Franks, trying to leverage them into the Hun camp. Though this all seems very confusing, and it makes it very difficult to discern Attila's true motives, I think the strategy could not be clearer. Sow discontent amongst the armed forces of the West, so that they are unable to form a coalition against the advancing Huns. And in early 451, the Huns began to advance. Aetius, currently down in Italy, recognized the need for a coalition as clearly as Attila recognized the need to prevent one from forming. The bottom line was that if the armed peoples of Gaul did not band together to face this mutual enemy, they were all going to be destroyed. So with Attila sending out his contradictory envoys to everyone, Aetius sent out envoys of his own that simply said, "Don't be stupid. The Romans are not your enemy. The Huns are all our enemy." But with a mix of mixed messages floating around, it was hard to know who was really your friend, who was really your foe, and who was strong enough to make it all irrelevant, and so shouldn't we just join that side and hope for the best deal when the fighting stops? Unfortunately for everyone in Gaul, the seeds of discord sown by Attila were in full bloom by the spring of 451 when the Huns crossed the Rhine River. Source material for the subsequent campaign is sketchy at best, so it's difficult to discern exactly what Attila did to who and when he did it. Everyone has him entering Roman territory along the Middle Rhine, but then it gets a little muddled. Did the Huns really besiege and sack every major city on their way to Orléans? Mainz, Trier, Cologne, all sacked? Maybe, and I wouldn't put it past them after the work they had done in Moesia and Thrace just a few years before. But like I say, it's not at all clear. We can tentatively place Attila in Metz, in northwest Gaul, on April the 7th. And just so you know, I've thrown some maps up on the website to help you work through all of this. And then supposition and guesswork gets him to Orléans in the middle of June. Sources mention the old imperial capital of Trier being sacked along the way, and an old legend has a detachment of Huns arriving at the gates of Paris, only to be turned back by a devout Christian woman named Genevieve, or, more properly, Genevieve, who led the inhabitants of the city in a sort of prayer marathon. When the Huns then retreated unexpectedly without so much as firing a shot, everyone called it a miracle. And so Genevieve became Saint Genevieve, the patron saint of Paris. Or, if you prefer, Genevieve, the patron saint of Pelly. Whatever the route and whatever the damage done by the Huns, by mid-June, they had arrived at Orléans. Orléans was the home of a considerable garrison of Alans, technically allies of Rome, but who knows at this point, because word on the street is that the king of the Alans has made a side deal with Attila to open the gates to the invaders. When Attila arrived and the inhabitants of the city learned of the deal, they cried massive foul and shut the gates themselves. I can't find any explanation for how the citizens of Orléans managed to fend off the Alan garrison and keep the gates shut for as long as they did, but apparently they managed to hold out just long enough to prevent the city from being taken. There was a light at the end of the tunnel for the people of Orléans, because after 2 months of preparation and negotiation, Aetius was finally ready to make his move. The forces he had been able to muster from amongst the regular Roman army were not nearly enough for him to take on the Huns all by himself. So as I just said, the general had been working furiously to convince every barbarian nation in Gaul, large and small, to join him in an anti-Hun confederation. Initially, the reception to Aetius's plea was muted at best, but it soon became apparent that as the Goths went, so too would go the rest of the inhabitants of Gaul. Basically, if Aetius could get the Goths to come fight, then everyone else, Franks, Burgundians, Alans, whoever, would join the fun. But convincing the Goths was proving to be no easy task. The Gothic king, as you'll recall, still Theodoric after all these years, was unimpressed with Aetius's army when the general came knocking in the late spring of 451. There were simply not enough Roman soldiers to make a direct assault on the Huns, even with Goth reinforcements, anything but an incredibly risky bet. Theodoric was not blind to the threat posed by the Huns. He just took a hard look at the situation and determined that it would be better for his people to hole up in their own territory, bunch their forces together, and make a stand at a time and place of their own choosing. But Aetius was not going to take no for an answer, so he dispatched the hugely influential Gallo-Roman senator Avitus to talk to Theodoric and bring the king around. Avitus, you'll remember, was the one who had brokered the peace between the Romans and Goths back in 439, and who would, in just a few years, find himself elevated to the rank of Western Emperor, after the death of Valentinian III broke the imperial court wide open. Avitus had a close relationship with Theodoric, and after much cajoling, he was able to drag the Goths out of Aquitaine and into the field under Aetius's banner. With the Goths on board, other barbarian groups broke the Roman way, and by the time Attila arrived at Orléans, Aetius was leading a confederated army to relieve the city and hopefully drive Attila out of the west. Aetius arrived at the besieged city around June 15, just in time to save the beleaguered inhabitants. Attila had breached a portion of the wall and had already established a beachhead within the city when the news came that a massive Roman army was approaching. Unfortunately, we don't really have any idea just how big this army was, nor do we have any real idea how big Attila's army was. And it really doesn't help that all we have to go on are insanely inflated reports like Attila was leading an army 500,000 strong. Most of what I've read puts the opposing side somewhere between 50 and 75,000 men apiece, which sounds much closer to the truth, and which still makes the coming showdown one of the largest battles in late antiquity. The forces arrayed at the Battle of Adrianople, for example, were at most 25 to 30,000 aside, with the minimum thought to be maybe just 15,000 apiece. So, while we are not about to see a million men squaring off against each other in battle, we are talking about maybe 100 to 150,000, which is pretty enormous, especially given the age. Caught in the middle of a siege operation, Attila decided to withdraw and regroup, rather than immediately turn to fight Aetius. The Roman Confederation trailed the Huns east for an indeterminate number of days, until Attila landed on a spot he thought would be favorable ground for a battle, the Catalaunian Fields. Though the site of the battle has never been firmly identified, it was somewhere in the Champagne-Ardennes region. The two armies lined up in late June and proceeded to launch a full-scale assault on one another with no quarter asked or given. The details of the battle are just as confusing about every other detail of the Hun invasion of 451. Our principal source for all this is a 6th-century Byzantine historian named Jordanus, who was, by his own admission, summarizing the work of an earlier 6th-century Italian historian named Cassiodorus. So, no one anywhere near the actual battle itself. Jordanus says that, quote, "The battlefield was a plain rising by a sharp slope, which both armies sought to gain. The Huns with their forces seized the right side, the Romans, Visigoths, and their allies on the left. The battle line of the Huns was so arranged that Attila and his bravest followers were in the center." He then goes on to describe how this ridgeline became the center of the fighting. Except, I'm kind of having a hard time picturing it. Was the ridgeline in between the two armies, running parallel to their front lines, or was it off to one side, running perpendicular, so that only a wing of each side was involved in the fighting to take the high ground? And frankly, left and right of what? Can a brother get some cardinal points? If anyone can help straighten this out for me, it would be very much appreciated. I've got another map up that looks like the elusive ridgeline was off to one side, but I don't really know, and frankly, I'm not sure Jordanus does either. Anyway, the story then goes that the Roman Goth forces reached the high ground first and managed to repel all Hun attempts to take it. The Goths, who were working on the right, then managed to break through and send the Hun left into an unexpected retreat. As great as this punch through was, though, it came at a heavy price to the Goths, as Theodoric was killed in the midst of the final push. But the loss of the king was a small price to pay. The Huns had tasted defeat and were now on the run. The Roman, Goth, et al. Confederation had beaten the invincible Huns. But while this victory was sweet, It was not decisive. The Huns had pulled back, but they were not broken. Sure, Attila was pretty despondent that night in the fortified Hun camp, going so far as to begin construction of his own funeral pyre out of shame, until his captains pointed out that the Hun army was still mostly intact, their losses manageable, and the Romans only marginally better off. The Battle of the Catalaunian Fields was a setback, but it wasn't the end of anything. So buck up, Attila. There you go. Why don't you have some nice blood wine? We have some 2309, best in the empire. Attila was fully recovered by the next day, and as his captains promised, the defeat was merely a setback. But that said, the aura of Hun invincibility had definitely been shattered, both among the Romans and the Huns themselves. For the next few days, the two armies stared each other down and waited for the other to make a move. Finally, Attila decided that it just wasn't worth it. His supply lines were drawn out like crazy. Feeding his people was a major concern, and with Aetius riding high and breathing down his neck, the Huns weren't going to be able to scatter and forage the way they needed to keep up the campaign. So Attila began a slow retreat out of Gaul. As soon as the Huns began to move east, the ties that had bound Aetius's confederation began to fray. The Goths were now minus one king, and Theodoric's son Thorismund asked Aetius if his people could return to their homes and settle the question of succession. Aetius was, of course, nervous about such a huge chunk of his army breaking off, but I've also seen it hinted that he actively encouraged Thorismund to head home, because that way Aetius wouldn't have to share the extensive spoils captured from the Huns. Though the Roman army was now far weaker, the Huns made no move to retake the offensive. And for his part, Aetius was not crazy enough to make any move that might rile up the Huns as long as they kept moving east. The retreat was not a pretty one for the people inhabiting the lands Attila passed through, but there was little Aetius could do about that. And even if he could have, he might still have been fine with the Huns blowing off some steam. After all, he had to keep his eye on the ball. The Huns were leaving. Don't screw that up. Because if you had presented this scenario to Aetius just a month before, that is, the Huns retreating and the Roman army still in one piece, he likely would have scoffed at your pie-in-the-sky fantasizing. So though it was a slow and destructive retreat the Huns were engaged in, it was a retreat, and Aetius wasn't going to risk the big-picture victory by trying to hurry Attila along. I don't know how long the withdrawal ultimately took, but I imagine the Huns were back across the Rhine by early fall, and back on the Hungarian plain by winter. I also imagine Attila spent that winter brooding and brooding and brooding. By the spring of 452, Attila had pretty well worked himself up into a vengeful fury, and was more than ready to go show the West just how not defeated the Huns really were. But this time, rather than swinging into Gaul, Attila drove straight for the heart of the Western Empire. The Huns crossed the Alps and poured unchecked into the Po Valley, ready for some serious ravaging. The first city they hit, of course, was Aquileia, which had so often repulsed the would-be ravagers of Italy. But as we've discussed, the Huns are different. The fortifications of Aquileia were crushed, and the Huns broke into the city in short order. Not content with simply sacking Aquileia, the Huns proceeded to smash and smash and burn and smash until the city was reduced to its foundations. Really, to the point where the great fortified city was a practically unrecognizable pile of rubble. Though another city named Aquileia would eventually grow up on the site of the old city, for all intents and purposes, the Aquileia we've been talking about for the last few hundred years, as the focal point of so many invasions and defenses of Italy, is gone. An interesting upshot of this destruction, though, was that the inhabitants of the city fled into the marshes of the coastline, leading some scholars to reckon that a good chunk of them wound up forming a community on some islands in a lagoon, establishing the core of the modern city of Venice. The destruction of Aquileia sent shockwaves through the empire and put the fear of God into Valentinian III. Suddenly, the swamp surrounding Ravenna no longer seemed so impenetrable. So the emperor and his court packed their bags as quickly as they could and fled south to Rome. The Aurelian walls were still a thing to behold. Maybe they would prove to be as effective as the Theodosian walls had been at protecting Constantinople. Valentinian could only hope and pray, because it didn't look like there was much else that was going to stop the Huns. With Attila on the loose in Italy, Aetius was unable to raise the same sort of sense of camaraderie with the barbarian nations of Gaul as he had been able to the year before when their homes were directly threatened. And so, all he had at his disposal this time were the ultimately inadequate regular Roman forces. Next week, Aetius will do his best to harass the Huns as Attila marched from one conquest to the next in northern Italy. But though he was reduced to essentially waging a guerrilla campaign against Attila's supply lines, Aetius proved himself no less capable than when he was leading mighty armies in set-piece battles. And though it was almost certainly a combination of supply issues, disease, and bribery that finally led to Attila's withdrawal from Italy, I would hate to draw the ire of the Catholic High Command by not pointing most especially to the embassy of Pope Leo the Great, who single-handedly convinced the Huns to spare Rome and withdraw from the peninsula. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 173, The Broken Bow. After laying waste to Aquileia in the spring of 452, Attila and the Huns moved west across northern Italy, sacking every settlement they passed along the way. Though the imperial capital had moved to Ravenna 40 years earlier, the city of Milan remained the richest, largest, and most powerful city in the region, and that's exactly where Attila was headed. Aetius, and what forces he was able to muster, gamely tried to harass, hinder, and trip up the Hun advance, but there was only so much they could do. Though they made Attila's life difficult, and in time the constant harassment would wear the Huns down, but it was not enough to stop the Huns from reaching Milan. The former capital's defenses were impressive, but once again insufficient to hold off Attila. The only feather in the city's cap was that it held out long enough for the siege to become called a protracted siege. But in due time, the Huns once again prevailed, and Milan was sacked. Down in Rome, Valentinian and his exiled court could do little more than tremble behind the Aurelian walls. It was clear that no army or wall was going to stop Attila's inevitable march on Rome. So, maybe it was time for some good old-fashioned high diplomacy. It was worth a shot. It's not like they had anything to lose. So a deputation of a few distinguished senators was sent north, famously led by the Bishop of Rome, Leo I. The diplomatic mission traveled north, crossed the Po River, and located the Hun camp. What happened next is the stuff of legend. Attila met with Leo, heard what he had to say, and then, amazing, wondrous, miracle of miracles, decided to withdraw from Italy. This immediately became a watershed moment in the history of the Catholic Church, and a key step in the process that saw the popes emerge as dominant political figures in the post-imperial West. Now, This is not to take anything away from Leo, or to ignore the guts it must have taken to walk up to Attila unarmed and ask him to please leave Italy. But it was going to take a lot more than the request of a single priest to move Attila. So what was it? The Huns had just run roughshod over all of northern Italy. Nothing could stop them. So why were they pulling back? If it wasn't the personal diplomacy of Leo, then what was it? A few things immediately come to the surface. First of all, Leo's words were almost certainly backed with a large quantity of gold, which will get anyone interested in listening to what you have to say. Second, as had been the case with the campaign in Gaul, Attila was having trouble feeding his army. The Huns did not have the kind of supply network the Romans enjoyed, and instead lived off the land as they moved from place to place. But in 452, Italy was suffering from a famine. There was just very little food to be had. Third, the Huns were victims of their own success. Sacking city after city had left them laden with treasure and far less mobile than they had been at the beginning of the year. In other words, they needed to go home and make a deposit. Fourth, according to reports, the new Eastern Emperor Marcian was taking advantage of Attila's absence and launching raids north of the Danube. So just as the campaign in Italy was starting to bog down, reports started coming into the Huns that their families were under attack. And that's not something that you can just ignore. Fifth, and this one was probably the decisive factor, disease had begun to sweep through the Hun camps. The old historians describe it as a divinely ordered blight to punish Attila for his transgressions. But whatever it was quickly thinning the Hun ranks. You add all this up, and you get a Hun king ready to consolidate his gains and mitigate his losses. So before winter set in, Attila withdrew back to his homeland north of the Danube River. He would never return to the west. In early 453, Attila had already decided that as soon as spring arrived, he was going to turn his attention back to the east. While the Huns had been occupied in the west, Constantinople had decided to make another play at cutting off the indemnity payments. That, coupled with Marcian's attacks during 452, equaled a guaranteed Hun invasion of the east in 453. Maybe this time they could crack those Theodosian walls. But Attila would never get the chance. Marcian was himself preparing for the inevitable confrontation with Attila, when, according to legend, he dreamed that he saw Attila's bow broken at his feet. Less than a week later, messengers arrived with the stunning news. Attila the Hun was dead. There is absolutely no reliable account of his death, but two standard versions exist. The first is offered by the contemporaneous Greek historian Priscus, who reports that Attila got blind drunk while celebrating his latest marriage and then choked to death in his sleep. The other, more scandalous account, is that he was actually murdered by his new bride on their wedding night. An even more scandalous account is that Attila was assassinated at the order of Marcian, who obviously wanted no part of facing Attila in the field. However he died, Attila the Hun, the so-called Scourge of God, was dead, and the Roman world slept a little easier. With the sword of Damocles no longer hanging directly over their heads, the imperial courts of East and West were able to step out into the light, survey the damage Attila had wrought, and maybe entertain the idea of planning for the future again, rather than simply trying to react to the present. But though no one could have known it, Attila's would not be the only momentous death to hit the empire in the early 450s. In just a few short years, the men and women who had led Rome for the last generation would all be gone, replaced by a new slate of leaders who, for better or for worse, would lead Rome for the next generation. Now, I already accidentally blew by the first momentous death of the early 450s, because I got a little too caught up in Attila's invasion of Gaul. But in October of 450, just a few months after arranging the fateful marriage between her daughter Honoria and boring old Senator Herculanus, the great matron of the West, Galla Placidia, died. Given how long she was a central figure in Western politics, I mean, she first rose to prominence back when she was kidnapped by Alaric during the first sack of Rome, which was what, like 40 years ago? It is kind of shocking to think that Placidia was just 58 years old when she died. Not a young woman by any means, but certainly not some ancient relic. She had been the wife of a Gothic king and given birth to a boy who might have led the Goths and Romans into becoming a single people. She was the daughter of an emperor, the brother of an emperor, the wife of an emperor, and the mother of an emperor. Intelligent and self-confident, she herself has served as regent of the West for some 14 years. And though the ascension of her rival Aetius had curtailed some of her influence, Galla Placidia remained a towering figure until the moment of her death in late 450. A remarkable woman, to be sure. 3 years later, the next great imperial death hit, as Placidia's counterpart in the East, Aelia Pulcheria, died at the age of 55. When you get right down to it, these two women, Placidia and Pulcheria, perhaps define the first half of the 5th century better than any emperor, king, or general. Pulcheria, daughter, sister, and wife of successive emperors, had strode boldly onto the stage of world history at the tender age of 14, asserting her authority over the Eastern Empire, challenging and then besting God knows how many ministers and generals who were getting ready to have their way with the underage Theodosius II. Though we didn't get too much into it, as an utterly devout Orthodox Christian, Pulcheria was responsible for building up entire quarters of Constantinople dedicated to housing and servicing the poor. Though, her religious devotion also led her to promote far less laudatory persecutions of pagans and Jews. For 40 years, Pulcheria stood at the center of the imperial court of Constantinople, acting as a rock of continuity as the ministers and generals of the East came and went. And in her last great act, she stepped into the power vacuum that opened when her brother died in 450, keeping the East from slipping into civil war. A book detailing the parallel lives and times of Galla Placidia and Aelia Pulcheria would make for great reading, if anyone feels like knocking one out for us. The deaths of Placidia and Pulcheria were acutely felt, but the bony finger of death was just getting warmed up. As I mentioned two episodes back, the question of who was going to marry Valentinian III's youngest daughter was fast becoming a hot topic in the court of the West. The rising officer Majorian had been put forward, but as you'll recall, Aetius had stepped in and exiled Majorian before the young man's nomination could get off the ground. Clearly, Aetius wanted no one to stand in the way of his own son, Gaudentius, and it appears that in 453, the general got his way. Valentinian agreed to an engagement between Gaudentius and Placidia the Younger. But though the engagement put Aetius tantalizingly close to becoming patriarch of the next imperial dynasty, it also likely sowed the seeds of his own destruction. Valentinian had spent his entire life under the thumb of the powerful Aetius, and the betrothal of his daughter to the general's son very likely put a simple thought into Valentinian's head. I wonder how long it will be before Aetius kills me and declares his own son emperor. Will it be on the night of the wedding itself, or will he wait a few days? And if Valentinian didn't actually come up with this thought himself, two members of the imperial court almost certainly conspired to put it there. The imperial chamberlain Heraclius and the wealthy senator Petronius Maximus. Now, as imperial chamberlain, Heraclius needed no specific motivation. Imperial chamberlains are apparently a uniformly sneaky and conspiratorial lot. But Maximus is a different story. A longtime Aetian loyalist, he apparently turned on his patron as a part of a larger project to take revenge on Valentinian. Revenge he knew would be impossible as long as Aetius stood in his way. According to a convoluted story related by 7th century historian John of Antioch, Valentinian had won one of Maximus's family rings in a bet, then used that ring to lure Maximus's wife to court, and then proceeded to rape her. And this is not a pretty story, but it is also one that may have been invented later to give a more emotional explanation for Maximus's actions. Throughout 454, Heraclius and Maximus worked steadily to erode Valentinian's faith in Aetius and replace that faith with intense fear and distrust. Once they had the now 34-year-old emperor on the hook, they began broaching more intense subjects. Aetius is a threat to you, became shouldn't you get rid of Aetius, became shouldn't someone kill Aetius, became finally shouldn't you kill Aetius. Now there's no way to know whether Valentinian's fear of Aetius was legitimate. That is, whether Aetius would have actively conspired to murder the emperor and elevate his son to the throne, or whether he would have been content to just let nature take its course. But given Aetius's history of ambitious backstabbing, Valentinian's fears were, I think, at least justified. This all led up to one of the most dramatic assassinations in Roman history. In September of 454, Aetius was in Ravenna, briefing the emperor and his ministers on the state of the army's finances, when, after the general turned his back for a moment, the emperor himself pulled out a dagger and stabbed Aetius to death. Valentinian obviously felt that killing the general was necessary, and that this was the only way to get to him. But still, usually, emperors enlist underlings to assassinate their enemies, rather than the other way around. Aetius was 58 years old, and had more or less held the Western Empire together for 21 years. Shortly after the murder, Valentinian was confronted by the bishop Apollinaris, who allegedly said, "I am ignorant, sir, of your motives. I only know that you have acted like a man who cut off his right hand with his left." Which just about sums it up. Aetius may have been treacherous and ambitious, but he was a damned effective general and administrator. Killing him may have been an act of preemptive self-defense, but it certainly didn't do anything to help the disintegrating Western Empire. And ultimately, it didn't do anything to save Valentinian either, because it's not like Aetius didn't have allies who would happily avenge their patron if given the chance. They would be given the chance less than a year later, when it turned out that the conspiratorial marriage between Heraclius and Maximus was a marriage of convenience. They were not allies so much as enemies of the same man, and now that that man lay dead, they divorced almost immediately. Maximus was expecting to succeed Aetius to the position of commander-in-chief of the Western legions. He may have had a deal with Heraclius to that effect, but it's also possible that he was just making assumptions, and we all know how rotten assumptions can be. In the immediate aftermath of Aetius's death, Maximus attempted to step into the dead general's boots, but he found himself blocked by, that's right, Heraclius, who feared a loss of influence if his co-conspirator Maximus was able to grab that much power. So he whispered in Valentinian's ear and killed Maximus's shot at the job, which, as you can imagine, ticked Maximus off something fierce. Here he had gone to all this trouble to get Aetius killed, and he wasn't even going to reap any kind of reward. So, murderous conspirator that he was, Maximus began to murderously conspire with some of Aetius's old confederates to murder the emperor. And this is when the rape story begins to ring a bit hollow. When discussing Aetius's murder, John says that the whole thing was about Maximus avenging his wife. But when it comes time for him to kill the rapist emperor, John merely talks about Maximus's bitterness over having been passed over for promotion. And that just seems like a really weird disconnect. Anyway, keeping his own role in Aetius's death a secret, Maximus enlisted two Hunnic bodyguards who had served the late general loyally for years. While visiting Rome in March of 455, Valentinian, accompanied by Heraclius, decided to go out riding and maybe practice some archery. So out went the imperial entourage, which naturally included the two Hun bodyguards. As soon as Valentinian dismounted from his horse, the two bodyguards charged forward, one targeting Valentinian and the other targeting Heraclius. Both were stabbed to death. Valentinian was 35 years old, and having ascended to the throne at the age of 6, he had technically been Emperor of the West for 29 years, though for most of that time real power lay first with Galla Placidia, and then with Flavius Aetius. As had been the case in the East just a few years before, the death of the heirless Valentinian III left a gaping hole in the political hierarchy that the Western Empire had not dealt with in more than half a century, going all the way back to the civil wars that had followed the death of Valentinian II in 392. Remember that? Yeah, that was a long time ago. Petronius Maximus was no dummy, though, and he had timed the assassination to take place in Rome while he was there, so that he could be Johnny on the spot. Because remember, this time, there was no imperial sister around to marry some stooge and make him emperor. The wayward Honoria had been exiled shortly after her wedding proposal to Attila, and then she simply disappears from the historical record. Maximus, banking on the ironclad law that fortune favored the bold, and the fact that he was the only one even remotely prepared for the death of Valentinian, since he, you know, planned it, was the first one to step forward and declare his willingness to rule the Western Empire. But though he was the first, much to Maximus's great annoyance, he was not the only one to step forward. A now wealthy former bodyguard of Aetius's named Maximianus was backed by the old Aetian faction of the imperial court, while the soon-to-be emperor Majorian, who had returned to favor after the death of Aetius, was being backed by the army. Petronius Maximus had the support of the Senate, though, and with it, the support of the Senate's wealth. He lavishly distributed bribes throughout the upper reaches of the imperial bureaucracy, and in short order, found them spontaneously backing his claim to power. And so Maximus became emperor of the Western Empire. To legitimize his claim, he quickly married the emperor's widow, Aelia Eudoxia, which, as I noted when Aetius married Bonifacius's widow, must have been pretty gross for her. The death of Valentinian III marks the end of an era in Roman history, and it's a pretty big era at that. The end of imperial dynasties, at least in the West. For 500 years, we've had the Julio-Claudians, and then the Flavians, and then the Antonines, and then the Severans, and then, well, everything went to hell for a little bit. But eventually, we got to the Constantinians, and then the Valentinians, and then the Theodosians. But with the death of Valentinian III, all we're left with now is a random grab bag called the Final Emperors of the Western Empire. Weak, disjointed, increasingly powerless. A list of names without real authority, or even a real empire to rule, that finally winks out of existence at Romulus Augustulus, whose name brings us full circle back to the founder of the empire and to the founder of Rome itself. Though the exile of the puppet boy emperor was considered an unremarkable afterthought at the time, it soon began to designate the official fall of the Roman Empire in the popular imagination. This designation is, of course, arbitrary and forced. In many ways, the Roman Empire died when Maximinus Thrax overthrew Alexander Severus. In many ways, it died when Diocletian reformed its structure, and then again when Constantine replaced its religion. Then again, in many ways, it would not really die until the passing of Justinian, the last of the Latin emperors, and the man who nearly bankrupted the East, trying to reclaim the West. In many ways, it would not die until the Turks blasted a hole in the side of the Theodosian walls in 1453. And then there's Philip K. Dick. He said that the empire never ended. But these two are all artificially imposed divisions, invented by historians to help keep the past manageable. Because without those artificially imposed divisions, every book, every class, and every podcast would have to be called The History of the World, 4.5 billion BC to the present. After all, it really is just the one long narrative, drifting seamlessly from one briefly held form to the next. Which brings me to what I now need to say. The history of Rome will be ending with the exile of Romulus Augustulus, last emperor of the Western Roman Empire. I know that is not what many of you want to hear, and in many ways, it is not what I want to be telling you. But it is what is going to happen. The time is right for me to let it end. To let it end while it is still good and strong, rather than dragging it out until it dies in some obscure corner of the internet, long since abandoned by everyone who once loved it, because it has degenerated into an endless string of weddings and births and contrived romances, like the crappy 14th season of some sitcom you can't believe is still on the air. I would like to be better than that. But more importantly, the time is right because in about 2 months, I don't think I'm going to have the time or the energy to make the show as good as I expect it to be. You see, Mrs. The History of Rome is 7 months pregnant with our first child. And by all accounts, babies pretty much change the whole equation. Sometimes I'll get emails from people that read like, "How do you find the time to produce the podcast? You must not have kids." Which has been true, and is still true right now, but won't be very, very soon. The pacing seems poised to land the show on 476 AD just at the moment when my son is going to be born seems too auspicious a portent to ignore. So I'm not going to ignore it. We're at 455 AD right now, so we have about 20 years left. It's an action-packed 20 years, so it's not like I'm signing off tomorrow. But the life of the history of Rome can now be measured in weeks. I'm not sure exactly how long it will take to get from here to there, because things always seem to pop up that I want to talk about, but I would reckon that the number of episodes left is now in the single digits, which is a crazy thing to think about. The history of Rome has been my life, day in and day out, for almost 5 years now. I'm not sure what I'm going to do when it's over. Oh wait, that's right. I'm going to have a baby to take care of. I'll thank you all again when the time comes, but I would like to thank you now too, because I really can't thank you enough. Thank you for letting me do the history of Rome. Okay, next week, just to really drive home the depressing point that this is all coming to an end, Rome is going to get sacked again. The aftermath of Valentinian's assassination is going to be a very confusing time for the Western Empire, and attempting to consolidate power, Petronius Maximus is going to piss the Vandals off something fierce, leading them to sack Rome in August of 455. Which, just for the record, is yet another arbitrary point some historians use to designate the official fall of the Roman Empire. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 174, The Sack of Rome, Part 2. Last time, we left off with the assassination of Valentinian III, last of the Theodosians, and the subsequent elevation of Petronius Maximus, first of the so-called shadow emperors, those pale imitations who bickered over an ever-shrinking imperial pie in the last days of the Western Empire. Petronius Maximus would get this terminal phase started in fine style by reigning for just 77 days in 455 AD. His major accomplishment? Provoking the Vandals to sack Rome. We are indeed a long way from the golden age of the Antonines. Maximus's problem was that he didn't really have any inherent imperial legitimacy. He had killed the previous emperor and had spread some bribes around, but that was really all he had going for him. So as I mentioned last week, he forced the emperor's widow, Licinia Eudoxia, to marry him. After all, she was not just the wife of the late Western Emperor Valentinian III, she was also the daughter of the late Eastern Emperor Theodosius II. So she was just oozing legitimacy. And marrying her was not only practical, it was kind of necessary given the circumstances. But Maximus was not content to stop there. He wanted to firmly intertwine his own family with the Theodosians and spawn a new dynasty. So Maximus named his son Caesar, and then married the boy to Valentinian and Licinia Eudoxia's eldest daughter, the now 15-year-old Eudoxia the Younger. Except that, if you'll recall, her hand had already been promised to the Vandal prince Hunneric. This wedding had not yet taken place, but neither had it ever been called off. Maximus obviously thought that with Valentinian dead, he could start rearranging dynastic marriages as he saw fit. But, well, King Genseric did not take kindly to the change in plans. After all, he was about to marry his son into the Roman imperial family, and that is not something you just let slip away. So how did Genseric find out that the engagement was canceled, and that Eudoxia was going to be married off to some usurping senator's son? He was alerted by the mother of the bride and recently widowed Licinia Eudoxia. She knew darn well that Maximus had killed her husband, and so, taking a page from the playbook of her, let's see, what would she be, cousin-slash-sister-in-law, Honoria, Licinia Eudoxia wrote a letter to Genseric begging the Vandals to come save her and her family from the brute Maximus. When this letter arrived, Genseric blew his top and mustered an invasion force almost immediately. Whoever this Maximus character was, he was going to rue the day that he had messed with the Vandals. Back in Rome, Maximus was settling comfortably into his new role as emperor, ready to enjoy all the powers and luxuries that came with being the supreme leader of a mighty... What's that you say? The Vandals have set sail from North Africa? Really? Well, that can't be good. Where do you suppose they're headed? Oh, they're headed here! Oh my. Well, better call out the legions. What's that? We really don't have any legions anywhere in the area? Well, what should we do? Panic? Yes, let's do that. Let's panic. Knowing that he had nothing even close to enough troops to fight the Vandals, and that it was almost guaranteed that someone would eventually betray Rome to the barbarians to save their own skin, Maximus told the frightened citizens of the city to just make a run for it. The Vandals are coming. I can't stop them. Best to just literally head for the hills and wait until they're gone. The citizens of Rome took Maximus's advice and began pouring out of the Eternal City. But before they left, they decided that it really wouldn't be right to just let Maximus off the hook for provoking a Vandal invasion like that. There are a couple of different versions of the story, but basically, as the emperor was preparing to make his own escape, he was tracked down by a mob, stoned to death, torn limb from limb, and then had his bits and pieces thrown into the Tiber. He was about 60 years old and had called himself emperor for 2.5 months. 3 days after Maximus was consumed by this angry mob, the Vandals arrived on the Italian coast and marched on Rome. No one stood in their way. The gates of the city were not even locked. Genseric entered Rome and commenced with a good and proper sacking. Now, there's some controversy about when the sack actually took place, with some sources saying late May, others saying early June, while still others say that it wasn't until August. But the sources generally agree that Maximus did not reign for more than 3 months, that Valentinian III died in March, and that Maximus died before the Vandals arrived. So I'm not sure where the August date is coming from. But other than that, I don't think that we can be so confident in our sources that we can just definitively say, no, it was on June the 2nd, 455 AD. So when you're asked on the test, when did the Vandals sack Rome? All you need to put is 455. Half credit if you say after the Goths sacked Rome. Quarter credit if you say sometime after Constantine. No credit if you ask what a Vandal is. Negative credit if you ask what a Rome is. Like the Gothic sack 45 years earlier, the Vandal sack turned out to not be all that we have been led to believe that it was. Yes, the Vandals occupied the city for 2 weeks, and yes, they carted off most of the treasure the Goths had not already carted off. But it was not mindlessly terrorizing and destructive. Archaeologists sifting through the layers of Rome haven't really found anything that points to a widespread general destruction of the city in the 5th century, and they actually have ways of determining these sorts of things using, like, science. This conclusion jibes with the stories about Pope Leo I, soon enough to be known as Leo the Great, for obvious reasons, convincing Genseric to forgo putting Rome to the torch and instead limit himself to simple plundering. Genseric was either swayed by the Pope or was already planning on limiting the scope of his conquest. And so, unlike the Huns at Aquileia, when the Vandals withdrew from Rome 2 weeks later, it still stood. But that did not mean that they did not strip the city bare. Sources mention that not only was all the treasure Titus and Vespasian had brought back from Judea hauled off, but half the roof of the Temple of Jupiter was too. As controlled as the sack was, though, it did not stop the word Vandal from entering our lexicon as one who willfully or ignorantly destroys, damages, or defaces property belonging to another or to the public. Since the ancient world is absolutely riddled with Romans and barbarians alike willfully destroying each other's property, it's kind of unfair to saddle the Vandals with this kind of denotative baggage. But on the other hand, I imagine they'd be happier about it than what happened to the poor Goths, a proud nation of noble warriors, whose name now inexplicably means vampire-loving sad sack. When the Vandals withdrew from Rome and sailed back to North Africa, they also took with them the greatest prize of all, and the prize that they had come for in the first place, the Augusta, Licinia Eudoxia, and her two daughters, Eudoxia the Younger and Placidia. The three imperial women would be held by the Vandals as extremely well-treated prisoners for the next 7 years, and the marriage of Hunneric and Eudoxia took place as scheduled. The union produced the future Vandal king Hilderic, who had both Vandal and Theodosian royal blood running through his veins, and who would make for a very controversial figure in the 6th century, and thus, sadly beyond our scope. But more important than what they took with them is what the Vandals left behind, namely a psychologically scarred Roman population and an imperial power vacuum. Since Maximus's death, no one was technically in charge of the Western Empire, and with Rome reeling from the invasion, it did not look like either the Senate or the Italian armed forces were going to get their act together anytime soon to nominate a new candidate for the job. Which brings us to Aparcius Avitus, the Gallo-Roman senator who has been popping up off and on over the past 25 years, usually when it comes time to broker some kind of deal between Rome and the Goths, which is exactly why he is popping up now. After becoming emperor, Maximus wanted to make sure that the Goths would back him, and so he promoted Avitus to Magister Militum of Gaul and asked him to please arrange Gothic support for the new regime. But since Maximus was only emperor for 2 months before the sack of Rome, that meant that Avitus was just barely getting started when the news came that Maximus was dead. "So, who is emperor now?" asked the Goth king Theodoric II, who, by the way, had risen to power after killing his older brother Thorismund following the Battle of the Catalaunian Fields in 453. "Well, I'm not really sure," replied Avitus. "I guess we'll have to wait and see." "Why wait?" asked Theodoric. "You're rich, you're in control of the Gallic legions, and you know we support you 150%, so why don't you just become emperor?" When he did the math, Avitus realized that Theodoric had a point. With the Goths staunchly in his corner, he almost certainly commanded the largest military force in the Western Empire. So the question wasn't why, it was why not. So, accompanied by a Gothic army, Avitus traveled down to Arles and announced to the Gallic Provincial Council that he was willing to take power if they wanted him to. And they wanted him to. Getting one of their own in power was a hugely appealing prospect. They proclaimed Avitus Augustus on July the 9th, 455 AD. The new self-proclaimed by default whatever emperor spent the next 3 months consolidating his power base in Gaul before he moved over the Alps in September and entered Italy before winter set in. In a bit of a pleasant throwback to the good old days, though, Avitus did not head straight for Ravenna. Instead, he merely dispatched a Gothic garrison to go hold the city in his name, while he himself continued on to Rome. Maybe it was the political circumstances of the moment that drove his decision. Maximus's reign, brief as it had been based there, and the city had just been sacked and needed a psychological boost. But Avitus clearly felt the need to be in Rome rather than the now imperial capital of Ravenna, which, like I say, is a pleasant throwback to the good old days. But though Avitus had as good a claim to any to imperial power, that did not mean that he was the only interested party in who should rule the West. Ralph Matheson of the University of South Carolina identifies at least four other such interested parties: the Eastern Emperor Marcian, the Italian nobility, the just-departed Vandals, and the leaders of the Italian armed forces, Majorian and his Germanic colleague-slash-mentor, Ricimer. All of them could be theoretically induced to follow Avitus if he played his cards just right. Unfortunately, he would not play his cards just right. Not because he was a bumbling fool or anything, but just that these things are delicate and not a little bit unfair. Avitus started at the top and dispatched envoys to Constantinople seeking recognition for his rule. Either because the Eastern Emperor wanted to appoint his own man, or because he wasn't sure Avitus would survive and didn't want to put his own prestige on the line, Marcian was non-committal about backing Avitus. "Well, okay," thought Avitus, "no matter, he'll come around." He next sent envoys to Genseric, attempting to lay down some law. "I am not Maximus. I have an army. Don't even think about trying to invade Italy a second time." That sort of thing. Which, of course, Genseric scoffed at. As soon as March rolled around and the Mediterranean was safe for sailing again, the Vandals started raiding the Sicilian coast. But these raids were not all bad for Avitus. With the Vandals once again on the offensive, the new emperor dispatched Ricimer to head up the response. Avitus knew damn well that Ricimer and Majorian represented the greatest threats to his regime. Tying up Ricimer in what was sure to be a protracted conflict on the high seas would give Avitus just the kind of breathing room he needed, which is to say that as long as Ricimer was fighting Vandal pirates, he wasn't fighting Avitus. But this breathing space didn't really do Avitus any good. The political fractures in the West were by now simply too great to overcome, In another era, an emperor reigning from Rome with the backing of troops from Gaul would have raised very few eyebrows. But these days, Avitus and the Goths were seen just as much foreign occupiers as Genseric and the Vandals had been. And this was exacerbated because though the Goths supported Avitus, there was a certain implied quid pro quo that the new emperor could not ignore. So as the citizens of Rome took stock of the damage done by the Vandals, they were mighty annoyed to find Avitus siphoning off what little wealth was left and using it to pay his Gothic supporters. From his perspective, Avitus was simply using his imperial authority to pay soldiers in the employ of the empire. But to the Italians, it looked a lot like he was finishing what the Vandals had started. Discontentment spread, and then, to make matters worse, famine once again reared its ugly head. Avitus was blamed for the grain shortages, even though there was little he could do about it. And by the autumn of 456, it was clear that it was time to get out of Rome while the getting was good. Better to head back to Gaul, where the climate was better. But he would never get off the peninsula. Ricimer had demonstrated his military talents throughout the summer by besting the Vandals in skirmish after skirmish, eventually forcing Genseric to recall his men and take stock of his sudden change in fortune. The year before, the Vandal king had stood on the Capitoline Hill deciding whether or not to burn Rome to the ground, and now his men couldn't even raid the coast of Sicily without getting tripped up. Ricimer was clearly a man who knew what he was doing. Riding high on these victories, the Germanic general returned to the mainland and began plotting with Majorian to dispense with their rival for power. The critical mistake Avitus made, and the catalyst that triggered Majorian and Ricimer to act, was his decision to send his Gothic allies on ahead of him. As I just noted, they had become a political liability, and so he ordered them back to Gaul, even though their presence was the main reason he wasn't being directly attacked. But Avitus misjudged the situation and thought that sending the Goths off would ease tensions rather than flare them up. But flare them up it did. With Avitus now essentially alone in Italy, Ricimer and Majorian pounced. The Italian legions moved on Avitus as the emperor neared Ravenna. Avitus closed ranks in the capital city with the forces he had left and may have been able to hold out for reinforcements from Gaul. But unfortunately, the terms of securing Gothic loyalty now came back to bite him. In exchange for supporting his claim to power, Avitus had offered Theodoric the opportunity to expand Goth dominion into Spain. Theodoric had immediately invaded the Iberian Peninsula and tried to take it over. So when the desperate call came in from Avitus for Theodoric to come down to Italy and help him defeat Ricimer and Majorian, the Goths were bogged down fighting in Spain, and Avitus was on his own. The now floundering emperor faced his adversaries near the city of Piacenza, but it was hopeless from the start. Ricimer and Majorian's forces overwhelmed him, and Avitus fled into the city. In October of 456, Avitus was officially deposed by Majorian and placed under house arrest. In an interesting twist, the deposed emperor was not immediately executed, as you would have expected given the circumstances. Instead, he was forced to renounce his titles and property and agree to become the bishop of Piacenza, a curious form of punishment, but one that removed Avitus from the political picture. He was about 60 years old and had ruled the empire for 15 months. It isn't entirely clear why Ricimer and Majorian decided to leave Avitus alive, but it may have had something to do with currying favor with the Eastern Emperor Marcian, who, though he had never supported Avitus, may not have been impressed by his cold-blooded execution either. The reason I say this is because Marcian continued to play coy with the would-be emperors of the West, even after the fall of Avitus. And so, during the winter of 456-57, Avitus lived. But in January of 457, Marcian died, and shortly thereafter, Avitus was killed. Marcian, by the way, was 65 years old and had been Emperor of the East for 7 years. His passing marks the official end of the Theodosian dynasty and the extended Valentinian Theodosian dynasty that had ruled the East for almost 100 years. Marcian's passing appears to have marked the end of leniency for Avitus, because shortly after the Eastern Augustus died, the deposed Western Augustus was either strangled or starved at Majorian's order, which is why I personally suspect that negotiations with Constantinople had some kind of impact on Avitus's curious fate. Because otherwise, why keep him alive just to kill him? But there is another possible explanation. Just as Avitus didn't have the support of the Italians, Majorian and Ricimer didn't really have the support of the Gauls. By keeping Avitus alive, they may have been hoping to prevent a Gallic uprising. But our sources hint that an uprising in Gaul started up anyway, as most of the nobility, and certainly the Goths, continued to recognize Avitus as the legitimate emperor. So, rather than allow a rallying point to live, Majorian had Avitus killed in early 457. But now the situation was really muddled. Marcian was dead, and so there was no emperor in the east. Avitus was deposed and then killed, and Majorian not yet elevated, so there's no emperor in the west. So who was running the show? The answer, of course, was the barbarian generals that good and proper Romans refused to let rule in their own right. In the west, that meant Ricimer, who was trying to rule the west in his own right with a commission granted by Constantinople, but who would settle for making Majorian a puppet emperor. In the east, we are still talking about Aspar, the ethnic Alan who had helped settle the Vandal question back in the 430s and who had remained a powerful force in Constantinople ever since. When Marcian died in late January 457, the Eastern court debated for 11 days who would succeed him. At first, it appeared that Marcian's son-in-law, Anthemius, grandson of the Praetorian prefect Anthemius, who had built the Theodosian walls, would get the nod. But Aspar stepped in and pushed for a Thracian general named Leo. Aspar finally got his way, and on February the 7th, 457, Leo was crowned Emperor Leo I. The new emperor was supposed to be a weak-willed puppet who Aspar could control, but it quickly became apparent that Leo had a will of his own. But the elevation of Leo had little immediate impact on the question of who controlled the West. Next week, though, Ricimer and Majorian will sort it out for themselves. Tired of waiting for Constantinople to nominate someone, anyone to rule, Ricimer will resign himself to the fact that he will not be able to rule the West in his own right, and instead he will push Majorian to become Augustus. By sheer coincidence, it was on April the 1st, 457 AD, exactly 1,555 years ago, that Majorian became emperor of the Western Empire. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 175, Trying to Take It All Back. Following the defeat, deposition, and execution of Avitus, the Western Empire was once again left without an officially recognized ruler. At least, that's how the leaders of the West looked at it. According to Constantinople, the western half of the empire had been without a ruler since the assassination of Valentinian III almost 2 years before. The Eastern Augustus Marcian had never recognized Petronius Maximus or Aparcius Avitus, and it didn't look like he had any interest in recognizing the new would-be emperor Majorian either. The general Ricimer tried to exploit this unwillingness on the part of the East to legitimize the emperors of the West by attempting to secure a sort of viceroy commission for himself to personally rule the western provinces, but in the name of Constantinople. But then Marcian died, and Leo the Thracian became emperor of the East, and he didn't appear keen to recognize Majorian as emperor or let Ricimer rule as a viceroy, which was no doubt a little frustrating for them, especially since Leo had no more claim to power than they did. Marcian, at least, had the lingering legitimacy of having married into the imperial Theodosian family. Leo was just some general. So, whatever. By the spring of 457, Ricimer finally gave up on the idea of becoming viceroy, and knowing that the Italian nobility would never accept him as emperor because of his German heritage, he backed his protege Majorian for the job. In a ceremony in Ravenna on April the 1st, Majorian was crowned with the diadem and took over official control of the West. But though the diadem sat on Majorian's head, it was clear that he was really co-ruling with Ricimer. Leo and the court of Constantinople did not immediately recognize Majorian, but really at this point, who cared what they said? It's not like Majorian was so offensive to the East that they were going to raise an army to throw him out of power, so you guys do what you want. We'll be over here running the West. But the West was now a pale shadow of its former self. Britain was gone. North Africa was gone. Most of Gaul was split between barbarian factions, and Spain was now slowly but surely being conquered by the Goths. And you can be sure that the Goths had no interest in letting Majorian tell them what to do. So when the two generals seized power, they were basically seizing control of Italy, and only Italy. Everything else was out of their control. The Romans had not been so geographically circumscribed since the days just before the Punic Wars, some 700 years earlier. But Majorian and Ricimer were ambitious men and vigorous soldiers. They were not going to be content with sitting around Ravenna, running out the clock, governing the Italian peninsula. No, they were going to push back against the tide of history. They wanted it all back. Gaul, Spain, North Africa, hell, even Britain if they could swing it. In the minds of Ricimer and Majorian, their rise to power was going to be a turning point in history, the moment when the Western Empire returned to glory. But though, as we're about to see, they made a pretty good run at it, in the end the tide of history was too great to overcome. That and the petty jealousies that so often ruin good work just as it's getting started. Majorian and Ricimer spent the rest of 457 consolidating their hold over Italy. There appears to have been some sort of attempt by the Alemanni to take advantage of the chaos by possibly raiding over the Alps, or at least getting ready to raid over the Alps, because right off the bat, Majorian is credited with winning some sort of victory against the Germans. For the next year and a half, the new regime focused its attention primarily on questions of Italian security, but they also began to make legislative claims on Gaul. When it came to Italy, the biggest threat was obviously posed by the Vandals. Though Ricimer had beaten them back in 456, the Vandals had regrouped and started raiding the Italian coastline again. At some point in 458, Majorian himself led a counterattack against a force of Vandals invading Italy, and Genseric's brother-in-law was killed in the fighting. To help secure the peninsula in the long term, Majorian initiated the reconstruction of the Roman navy, a branch of the armed forces that had been completely neglected in recent years. With one fleet based on the Tyrrhenian coast and another based in Ravenna, Majorian hoped to bring an end to 25 years of the Vandals controlling the seas. In the midst of these operations, Majorian received a critical boost to his legitimacy in December 457 when envoys from Constantinople arrived with the news that Leo had decided to officially recognize Majorian as his co-ruler. For the first time in almost 3 years, East and West were on the same page. Constantinople's stamp of approval was going to make it hard for the citizens of the West to argue that Majorian was somehow illegitimate. But even still, the political, military, and religious leadership in Gaul were thoroughly disdainful of Majorian. They were not ready to forgive or forget the overthrow of their man, Avitus. Throughout 458, there is evidence that on questions of taxation, the Gallic nobility appealed directly to Constantinople for rulings, and that inscriptions from Lyon were dated only with reference to Leo. No mention is made of Majorian. There is also a passing reference made to a Marcellinian revolt, whatever that was, and whichever Marcellinus happened to be leading it. Majorian and Ricimer wanted Gaul to recognize their authority, but they were not so blind as to think that they were just going to get it for nothing. So, while they built a force of barbarian mercenaries that they planned to use to enforce their will in Gaul, they also laid the groundwork for a friendlier reception than the Gauls were probably planning on giving them right at that moment. And when you are a new ruler looking to make nice with a bunch of people who are not at all predisposed to liking you, what is the number one surefire way to bring them around? Did someone say tax relief? I thought I heard somebody say tax relief, which would be good because the answer is tax relief. As was so often the case, the collection of taxes was these days an intermittent and corrupt sort of thing. The richest landowners did their best to avoid giving anything to the central government, another one of the 257 different reasons why the Western Empire fell, which meant that the civil authorities were forever coming up short on the total due. Now, the rules of the game specified that if they failed to collect the proper taxes, that the civil authorities themselves would be on the hook for the shortfall. But these civil authorities, called the curions, were themselves basically middle-class bureaucrats who had no great fortunes to draw upon and who wielded no significant power over the people who did have great fortunes to draw upon. And so, they usually wound up turning viciously on the lower classes to extort every last dollar they could find. Even then, they all wound up woefully short. So the bottom line was that everyone owed the central government obscene amounts of back taxes, and the middle and lower classes were being squeezed to death. So Majorian passed laws specifically pertaining to Gaul that tried to rein in the rampant corruption, and then announced that the back tax debt was hereby canceled. So, I can't be all bad. In the autumn of 458, Majorian marched over the Alps at the head of a pretty good-sized army composed mostly of barbarian mercenaries to help bring Gaul under imperial control. Ricimer stayed behind in Italy, setting up the ruling dynamic that would hold for the remainder of the partnership between the two men, Majorian traversing the provinces trying to rebuild the empire, and Ricimer staying behind in Italy to mind the shop. Traveling with the emperor was a top lieutenant who had just been promoted to the rank of Magister Militum for Gaul. With the imperial authorities not really in charge of Gaul right at the moment, the promotion was more aspirational than factual. But in very short order, shorter order than one might reasonably expect, it would be quite factual. And then, it would become something more. So take note of the name Aegidius, the promoted officer in question, because we are not done with him by a long shot. The court of Ravenna had managed to hang on to the Gallic territory immediately abutting the Alps, but beyond that, Majorian had his work cut out for him. He wasted no time, though, and before winter set in, he marched due west. The most powerful force in Gaul was the Goths, and so it was the Goths whom Majorian would deal with first. No slow turning of the screw, no gradual tightening of the noose, a stab right at the heart. Theodoric II mustered an army when it became clear that the emperor was on his way. because there was no way he was just going to roll over. Avitus had finally given the Goths license to territorially expand to their heart's content. Theodoric planned to defend that right to the hilt. In late 458, the two armies faced off at Arles, site of so many Roman-Goth confrontations. But a willingness to defend something to the hilt is no guarantee of success. Majorian's army smashed the Goths up and won a decisive victory. Theodoric was forced to concede the rights Avitus had given him, and it was back to being a federated ally of Rome, to be used and not used at Ravenna's discretion. With the Goths cowed, the Gallo-Roman nobility had to take a good hard look at the situation and decide how much they were going to continue to resist the new regime. They may not like Majorian or what he had done to Avitus, but man, look at what he just did to the Goths. For his part, the emperor was not looking to punish their initial reluctance to back him. He adopted a conciliatory posture and offered top positions in his government to members of the Gallic aristocracy. Coupled with the cancellation of the tax debts, this left most of the major landowners in Gaul quietly accepting Majorian's authority. Which was good for the emperor, because he was really not trying to get bogged down in Gaul. He wanted to move on to Hispania and reassert imperial authority there. But Majorian was also hoping to not get bogged down in Hispania, because his ultimate goal was to use the ports of Spain as a springboard for an invasion of North Africa. And this was his real dream, to expel the Vandals from Carthage once and for all. Pull that off, and he becomes one of the greatest emperors in Roman history, a sort of mini Aurelian who reunites a broken empire. But first he had to make sure that he was launching from a secure base. The lands taken by the Goths were easily redrawn onto the Roman side of the map, but actually securing them, in fact, was a different story. The locals were starting to get ideas that maybe they didn't need to listen to anyone anymore, and so Majorian had to march around showing the colors to remind them all that, yes, there is still an empire, and yes, you still need to pay your taxes. Majorian also hoped to finally lance a boil that had been festering up in northern Spain since way back, right after the great New Year's Eve barbarian invasion of 405. A Germanic tribe called the Suebi had followed the Vandals and Alans into Spain, but they had stayed behind when Genseric led his people across the Strait of Gibraltar. Ever since, they had lived as a small de facto independent kingdom in northwest Spain. Majorian planned to crush them and return the whole of the peninsula to direct imperial control. Couple this with his plan to retake North Africa, and it is clear that Majorian wanted to write the final chapter of the New Year's invasion by destroying the last remnants of the invaders. While his army was off campaigning against Spanish holdouts, Majorian went down to the coast to initiate the construction of an invasion fleet. When Genseric found out what the Romans were up to, he started to worry a little bit. This new emperor was not like previous emperors, who had been docile toward, and even a little neglectful of, the Vandals. This Majorian, on the other hand, seemed obsessed. The new Roman fleet under construction in Italy was starting to hit the water. The emperor had himself beaten the Vandals in battle and killed Genseric's brother-in-law. And now an invasion fleet was under construction in Spain? I imagine that Genseric was missing old Aetius just about now. So the Vandal king did what any good statesman would do if he started to believe that the military balance of power was starting to shift against him. He offered to negotiate a settlement. But Genseric's newfound desire to talk was likely met with a few incredulous guffaws throughout the halls of Roman power. The courts of both East and West had been regularly sending diplomatic missions to North Africa since the sack of Rome, trying to get the Vandals to back off, and they had just as regularly been greeted by a dismissive wave of the hand. Now that the West was rebuilding its strength, now Genseric wants to talk? He was not going to get off that easily. This time, it was the Vandal emissaries who were dismissed. Rebuffed, Genseric took the rather extreme step of launching a scorched earth campaign against the North African province of Mauritania. But, you ask, isn't that territory held by the Vandals? Why would they want to scorch their own land? Well, to make life extremely difficult for the invading Romans, of course. Scorched earth meant no living off the land. It meant the Romans would be slowed down because they would be tied down to supply ships from Spain. But the Vandal king also launched a second initiative, one that would prove to be more directly successful, in which, I'm sure the people of Mauritania loved this, made the scorching of their earth totally unnecessary. The timeline gets a little muddled here, and it's difficult to tell whether this all happened in 460 or 461, but Vandal saboteurs were able to bribe or trick their way into the shipyards where the Roman invasion fleet was under construction in Spain, and once inside, the saboteurs went to work with the torches. Before anyone knew what happened, the entire fleet was in flames, and then it sunk to the bottom of the ocean. When Majorian learned what had happened, he surveyed the damage report with a resigned sigh. That fleet had been pushing the imperial budget to the limit. There was no way they could just start again from scratch. Bitterly disappointed, Majorian canceled the planned invasion. It was time to head back to Italy and regroup. So it's tough to tell when this actually happened, because all our fine sources say is that after Genseric torched the fleet, Majorian left Spain and headed back to Italy. Some imply that this was a bang-bang thing, and further imply that it was the loss of the fleet that caused the fatal rift between Majorian and Ricimer. Others imply that the fleet was destroyed sometime in 460, so it's possible that Majorian lingered in country for a while before leaving, or that he immediately left Spain but lingered in Gaul for a while before deciding to return to Italy. Whatever the exact order of events, in the spring of 461, Majorian was back in Arles and preparing to return to Italy. By the time he left Arles, it is almost certain that Ricimer had decided to move against him. Which brings us to the question of why Ricimer decided to take out his longtime partner, slash accomplice, slash protege, Majorian. They had been serving together for at least 20 years, going back to the campaigns of Aetius in Gaul. Ricimer had been the voice calling for Majorian's rehabilitation following the death of Aetius. The two had subsequently teamed up to form a powerful political faction following the death of Valentinian III, which culminated with their overthrow of Avitus in 456. So why was Ricimer about to throw all of that history away? In the Gallic Chronicle, it is simply reported that Ricimer was envious of Majorian, which may well have been the case. After all, Majorian was 15 years his junior. Subservience, even if it was merely technical, can't have sat well with Ricimer. If I were a speculating man, I would also guess that it had something to do with Majorian's success in retaking Gaul. This success rested a great deal on bringing the Gallic nobility over to his side, which meant that Majorian now had the building blocks for a power base independent of Ricimer. It also meant that Gallic nobles were going to get jobs that might have gone to Italian nobles. Whatever the wider merits of the strategy, this meant there are now plenty of irked Italians complaining to Ricimer that Majorian was forgetting who his friends were. And of course, we should not forget that Ricimer always wanted to rule in his own right. Majorian was just supposed to be a convenient puppet. It may well have been that Majorian was not dancing the way Ricimer wanted him to dance. As he traveled from Gaul to Italy, Majorian appears to have made exactly the same mistake Avitus had made back in 456. He dismissed most of his retainers and chose instead to travel with a small company of bodyguards and advisors. After all, he was just heading back to Italy, where his regime was strongest and where his old friend Ricimer was waiting for him. But as he crossed the Alps, his old friend Ricimer was waiting for him. On August the 3rd, 461, Majorian's entourage was surrounded by Ricimer's forces, and the emperor was taken into custody. Whatever had been Majorian's crime, and whatever exactly were Ricimer's reasons, the emperor was held for 5 days, and after enduring prolonged torture, he was finally beheaded on August the 7th. He was about 40 years old, and had ruled the West for 4 years. In many ways, Majorian's downfall closed the door on any real resurgence for the Western Empire. Though I do think that Anthemius did enough to earn the title last halfway decent emperor of the West, it all depends on how you grade them. Lots of people say that no, it was actually Majorian who deserves the title. He vigorously attempted to reclaim what had once been Rome's, defeated numerous foreign enemies in battle, strengthened the navy, and was in the process of reforging the political bonds between Italy and the provinces. Had Genseric saboteurs failed, we might be talking about Majorian as the man who won back North Africa. He was only 40 years old when he died. He was a smart guy and a good general. He might have been able to pull something off. But then he got killed, almost certainly because he was a smart guy and a good general. He almost certainly was not turning out to be the kind of puppet Ricimer wanted him to be. Next week, we will get into the disastrous consequences of Ricimer's decision to overthrow Majorian. Just at the moment when it looked like the West was working its way back into fighting shape, Ricimer would throw it all away, appearing to choose undisputed master of Italy over de facto co-ruler of a reunited West. Because when the dust settled, 4 years of Majorian marching around had been for naught. The Western Empire was right back where it started, and it didn't look like it was going anywhere anytime soon.